My name is Ari Lannis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, I am joined by a very special woman, Valerie Kaur, one of the most prominent interfaith activists in all of the United States. We discuss storytelling as a method of social change, being a sick American, and Harry Potter, and the influence Harry Potter had on her own beginnings as a social justice advocate. Thank you for listening to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation. I am joined today by Valerie Kaur, the founder of Groundswell out of the Auburn Seminary, as well as a law and justice fellow at Stanford University. Also, someone who I met early on in my own journey within the interfaith movement, someone who I've been following from afar for many years, who does incredible work. Valerie, thank you for joining us on the Multifaithful podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, in your bio, which I just truncated a lot to fit into a little window at the beginning, because if I read the whole thing, we'd probably take the whole half hour we have. Your kind of tagline for yourself is storytelling for social change. So, I'm curious why the focus on storytelling, what drew you to that, and how has that, an interest in storytelling, led you to interfaith and multifaith work?
Well, I believe that stories can save us. Stories can break us open, can bind us to each other, can make us brothers and sisters to one another like no other tool that we have. And even though I'm a lawyer, I'm a filmmaker, I'm an interfaith organizer, but at the core, I see myself as a storyteller. In other words, I'm able to use these different platforms to lift up the stories of communities who are struggling for justice. Stories, I believe, are the driver for the great social movements of our time. And so I feel honored to be able to use all the tools at my disposal to use stories for social change.
And so your first film was Divided We Fall, which was about being sick in the United States after 9/11, right?
Yes.
And so I think I remember from the film, you put together that film at the time when you were a college student.
Yeah. So I was 20 years old when 9/11 happened. And I remember feeling paralyzed by overwhelming grief and really trying to comprehend the incredible loss of life in New York and D.C. And I was glued to my television set, watching the towers fall over and over again between these images of a man with a turban and beard. It occurred to me that Osama bin Laden, our nation's new enemy, looked like my family, looked like my grandfather and uncles and brothers. And my family has been in the United States for more than 100 years. My grandfather settled in California in 1913, and so I've had deep, deep roots in the United States. But in that moment, Sikh families across the country, along with our Muslim brothers and sisters, were seen as automatically suspect, perpetually foreign, and potentially terrorist. And it was only really minutes before we began to hear news of hate violence breaking out on city streets across America.
Yeah.
And the first person who was murdered that Saturday was Bobir Singh Sodhi, a man who I considered an uncle. So here I was at Stanford University. I was in this place of incredible safety and privilege. And yet the world was burning and my community felt, my country was under attack and my community was under attack.
Right.
And so I retreated in that moment. I remember escaping to my room and I was a student of religion actually. And so I had a book case filled with amazing texts, like from the Bible to Quran to the Dhruv Granth Sahib. I had incredible resources I could pull down to give me some source of wisdom or clarity, but do you know the story? Do you know what book I ended up pulling down?
I don't.
Can you guess? It's the text of our generation.
The text of our generation?
Yeah.
Now I'm embarrassed that I'm not sure what it is.
I I pulled down Harry Potter.
Oh! I have to be honest, and this may lose us some listeners, but I actually never read Harry Potter. I was always a Lord of the Rings fan, and it just never, I never got into Harry Potter.
Well, that works too. It's like the young and the small.
Exactly.
The dark arts in the world, right? The Dementors, the dark forces. And I escaped in that story. And I think it was because here is a story of young people wielding a kind of magic when the adults in their lives wouldn't or couldn't. And I finally put the book down and I realized that, you know, the stories of the Sikh community, just as growing up in California would open my history book, and the stories of Sikhs who survived the partition of India were not in my history book. Just as the Sikh genocide of 1984 was not mentioned, so too would these stories that were unfolding in that moment, right outside my window, so too would they be buried unless we started capturing them. And this was, of course, this was before Twitter and Facebook.
Right.
And before YouTube, but we did have cameras that were available.
It's a wild concept.
Smart cameras. Yes. I mean, this was really a turning point, really.
Yeah.
For who has the power to tell stories and who has the power to share those stories, who is framing the picture, who's holding the camera. And in that moment, I had a tool, I had a wand, you know, I had the ability to wield that kind of power. And even though I felt like I was the last person I would choose for such an endeavor, I thought, well, what if I started capturing these stories, stories of hate and violence, but also incredible healing and hope as Americans were trying to grapple with what has now become our new racial landscape.
Yeah.
And so I left Stanford. I grabbed my camera. I had a list of questions. I crossed the country. And that journey, going from home to home, arriving in places where sometimes the blood was still fresh on the ground, capturing the life of it, turned into my first film, Divided We Fall.
Right. Well, I mean, the film is fantastic. I absolutely loved it.
What did you see it?
What?
When did you see it?
I saw it a couple years ago, and then actually watched it again in preparation for this interview. But I remember seeing it years ago, especially just because as someone Jewish who is kind of culturally is very ingrained and sensitive to acts of discrimination. And, you know, after 9/11, I'm from New York, so I kind of grew up in New York in the frame of 9/11. And so films about religion in 9/11 have a particularly poignant frame for me as someone who grew up religious in this area after 9/11.
Yes. You know, I have to say, 12 years later, I really thought that the film was going to be a time capsule of a particular era in American history where we saw violence and fear seize the nation's imagination and put Muslim and Sikh communities in a place of tremendous threat and suffering. And yet, 12 years later, here we are, and we know that the Paris attacks have, you know, we are still counting the dead from the terrorism attacks in Paris. We are still reeling from that tremendous loss of life. And just as I felt after 9/11, there is a double pain because here again, we are feeling the rise of fear and animosity toward refugees, toward immigrants, and toward Sikh and Muslim Americans around the world, including in the United States.
Yeah, and this...
Yeah.
No, I was just saying, the timing is so difficult because we're recording this in the days right after, and tomorrow I have back-to-back, we're hosting a vigil on campus for the lives lost in Beirut and Paris, and then right after that I go to a meeting with students who are planning for awareness raising and fundraising around the issue of Syrian refugees. And those two events juxtaposed together are... I think super important to our students right now, and really in a lot of ways are mirroring a lot of the feelings and tensions we experienced as a country after 9/11.
And so here's what I think about when I think of your listeners right now, the students especially who are listening. We We want to call you to a life of service. We want to call you to face the dark arts, the dementors in your own life, however you see them. We want to call you to this path of love where you're wielding your own power and your own magic to try to make the world a better place. And yet, I have to tell you what I have only learned after walking the path, which is it comes at a cost.
What's the cost?
Drawing close to moments of violence and to suffering is like teetering at the abyss. It's like looking into the abyss.
Mm.
And if you sit there alone, then you will be swallowed by it. There have been moments where I have felt I have almost been completely taken inside of despair, of sadness, of depression. And any time that has happened, the only way I have not lost myself to it is because other people have taken hold of my hand and pulled me back. And those people are the friends that I made in school. They are the friends I made in college. They are my brothers and sisters who have reminded me that courage is only possible in community. I think too often activists or college students who go out to try to change the world get burned out. They become burned out idealists. They become angry.
Yes, very often.
Because they end up embodying the very dysfunctions that they're trying to heal out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They operate from a place of anger and stress and fatigue and a sense of scarcity, a sense that nothing may ever change because the road is so hard. It is so hard and it is so long and it takes decades for change to actually take place. That's how hard it is. And anytime that has happened in my life and the lives of others, I see that the only thing that really saves us is the love in our communities that reminds us that the promised land is around the corner, that love is revolutionary because it changes the world around us and within us. And that's the key, to be able to create a space in our hearts that nothing can touch, that the hot winds of the world cannot touch. And for me, that's where faith lives. But no matter if other students have a different faith or no faith at all, it's the space where love lives. And it could be the love of God or the universe, the love of your brothers or sisters, your best friends in school. But I think my power and the power of people who walk this path is based on protecting that space of love within them. Mm. And so if I have any advice for the students who are about to walk this path, it's that protect that space of love within you fiercely. Protect it like a flame in your heart. If you protect it enough, then your desire to make the world a better place will be fulfilled, can be fulfilled, because you're in it for the long haul. You're in the journey for a lifetime and not just for a few years, because love is everlasting. Love can make us more powerful than we can imagine.
I think it's a particularly poignant message, especially given at universities right now. Racial justice and issues of kind of racial equity are so much a part of the conversation, and those conversations are not directly tied to religion and spirituality in the same way that some of the other topics we've been discussing are. But one of the things I hear a lot from guest speakers who come to campus or activists is how important it is to have a community of self-care for people who are out and advocating for justice in any number of forms.
Yes, yes. I learned this the hard way. When I say that the path comes at a cost, probably my darkest moment was when I was behind bars. I was filming a protest in New York City to protect against police brutality. It was an anti-war protest. The NYPD came in with a lot of force and arrested people I was filming and then saw my camera and arrested me as well.
Oh, wow.
My handcuffs were so tight that I lost feeling in my hands. And when I asked an officer to loosen them, he came around and twisted my arm. And it felt like someone had sliced my arm off. And at that moment, the scripture came to my lips. It was Ikongai Satnam. It was the Mul Mantra. It was the heart of the Sikh faith, just to keep my body from flying into pieces. That's how desperate that moment was. And I remember lying behind bars with my arm on my chest, feeling so alone, And then closing my eyes and then knowing that my friends were on the other side of the prison walls, that my friends and family were fighting to get me out, that that love was present. And then closing my eyes and feeling my grandfather's love course through me, my grandfather who had faced race riots when he arrived in the United States, who had faced laws that prevented him from becoming a citizen, who had visited Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II when they were seen as the enemy, my grandfather who had seen all of these eras of U.S. history, and that I was just living the next era, that his courage was coursing through me. And I thought of the story of Mai Bago, this 17th century Sikh woman warrior who, when 40 soldiers abandoned their post, she said, "You will not abandon the battle. You will go back into the flames. You will go back into the fire, and I will lead you." And so she donned a turban and mounted a horse and grabbed her sword and shield, and she led them back into the fight. She became the one she was waiting for. And so I thought, okay, what is my sword and shield? What is my modern-day sword and shield? And it was in that moment behind those bars that I decided to go to law school, that I decided that my law degree, my film camera, that's how I would fight the good fight. And no one goes to battle alone, right? So I would do it with my brothers and sisters. And so it's in those moments of darkness, you know, that we find the gems of epiphany and revelation that then makes us better warriors, that then gives our life even greater meaning. And so that's why I would encourage those listening to walk this path and enter those moments of darkness, because on the other side, their lives are even more rich and their power is even greater. They just have to have faith that it's there waiting for them.
And you did law school afterwards at Yale, right?
I did, yeah. So I went to divinity school to learn religion at Harvard, and I completed my law degree at Yale. And so I see all of these as my sword and shield.
Right. And so I'm curious, when you were at Yale, if I know Yale these days right now is very much in the news for a lot of justice issues. I'm curious how your experience was there and if kind of conversations like this were fermenting and really important to your experience in the law school.
Yes. Well, the law school tends to be a space that is separate from the rest of the university. It is not as integrated as it is. So I can't claim to speak on behalf of the undergrads and their incredible struggle around race issues that they're dealing with now. I know that when I was there, I felt like Yale was a fortress surrounded by the larger community of mostly impoverished Black and brown families. And the divide was so intense that I could only feel at home being there if I was taking my work out into those communities. And so I spent much of my time at law school in clinics where we represent clients and causes. And my greatest experience was working in the worker and immigrant rights clinic in a town called East Haven, right outside of Yale. And we worked with Latino families on a campaign that lasted years to combat racial profiling at the hands of local police officers who were responsible for a pattern of practice of profiling, but also horrific instances of abuse. And who we worked with, the reason it worked, the reason our campaign worked, was that we worked with faith leaders. I remember the first night I sat in the basement of a Catholic church. And it was the priest who was leading the congregants in a reflection on who has the power in their town. And there's these Latino families, you know, with their kids on their laps saying, "Well, the mayor has the power, the police has the power." And then finally someone says, "Well, God has power." And someone in the front says, "Well, the people have power." And the priest says, "Yes, God has power when the people feel that love in their hearts. And together we can combat the greatest systems of oppression, and we have our lawyers in the room." And in that moment, I was just a student at that point, but we became a coalition of faith leaders and law students, lawyers, and community members to wage this fight. The Department of Justice launched an investigation because of our advocacy, and now the police department is completely transformed and really aimed at a mode of community policing. So whether it's police officers or whether administrators, which the students of Yale are now facing, I believe that when we are standing together across differences, whether it's differences in faith or differences in profession or difference in the communities we come from, when we build diverse coalitions, then our power is immense and change is possible, especially when we're leading from love.
Mm. That's great. You're a fantastic storyteller with these things. This is amazing. I'm just caught listening. I totally forgot what my next question was going to be. But I know I was actually playing around on your site before, and I noticed that one of the issues that you've really taken to recently is the internet. And what you've, I don't know if you termed it or someone you work with, faithful internet. And so I'm curious if you could explain a little bit why you think the internet is a next frontier for this type of organizing work that you're invested in, and what about this topic drew you in?
Sure. Well, it actually happened out of law school. I saw how faith leaders working with communities could lead these pockets of social change, you know, around the country. And I thought, what if when we were leading that site in East Haven, we had people of different faiths and backgrounds across the country stand behind us? You know, what if in the wake of the next hate crime, when the Sikh community is trying to respond, we had a way for people of different faiths and backgrounds across the country mm-hmm. to be right there with us. And so I founded Groundswell at Auburn Seminary. It's sort of like the Move On, but for the interfaith world.
Yeah.
It's the nation's largest multi-faith online organizing community. We lead by stories.
Yep.
And if you go there, it's groundswellmovement.org, you can see all of these campaigns, whether it's climate change or profiling or poverty or domestic violence, and people can join those campaigns, can lend their voices to those campaigns. So the next time a faith leader walks into the police department or a student walks into the administrator's office, they can stack pages of petitions and messages from people around the country who are standing with them. And so I wanted everybody to be able to experience the power I experienced, and that's what Groundswell is for. It's an mm-hmm. open platform that does that. And only after running Groundswell for a few years did I really come to understand that the only way that I have walked this path as a Sikh, you know, my first film, the only way people knew about Divided We Fall was because we were blogging about it. And then eventually when they were invented, we were using Facebook and Twitter and YouTube to share this word, to spread it. That's the only reason you have seen it.
Right.
The only reason that we are able to launch Groundswell was because we have an open internet where anyone with a good idea doesn't have any real barriers to pursue that idea and make it happen. All of that, my whole life, really, as a Sikh activist, is only possible because of the open internet. And yet, last year, we had huge corporations, Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, who wanted the power to block websites, to slow down certain websites, and to charge access fees, to charge extra fees for people like me, entrepreneurs like me, to reach their customers faster. I couldn't afford to be in the fast lane. The faith leaders I work with couldn't afford it. In fact, most communities who are struggling for justice couldn't afford to be in the fast lane. So that means that when people went online to reach our sermons, our calls to action, our vigils, they would face the buffering, spinning wheel of death, and they would click away. I think our entire future, the future of faith, the future of interfaith dialogue, the future of movement building depends on keeping the internet an open and free platform where every one of us has an equal voice. So that's why I hopped over to Stanford Law School. I joined the movement for net neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really proud to say that Faithful Internet was our baby. I worked with Cheryl Lianza at the United Church of Christ, and we created Faithful Internet. So we have voices like Reverend William Barber, Reverend Otis Moss III, folks in Pope Francis's office mm-hmm. Who really lent their voice to say that the internet was important for our shared future.
Yeah.
And as a result of a very diverse coalition, we had like companies like, you know, Netflix and Kickstarter and Etsy next to faith leaders, next to venture capitalists, next to educators. It was really diverse, right? A huge coalition, and 4 million Americans pouring comments to the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. That led President Obama and the FCC and our lawmakers to stand behind the open internet order. In February of this year, the FCC adopted the open internet order, giving us meaningful, strong rules to protect net neutrality in our country. It was an amazing fight. And so now I'm busy working with folks to defend the order in Congress and the courts. And I've been working in other countries in Europe and in India and around the world to make sure that they are able to protect the internet in their regions, because I think a whole new generation is relying on this. I have a one-year-old son, and I keep thinking, the internet that I want him to inherit, you know, I want him to be able to wield his special kind of magic, his power, when his time comes, the way that I have. So that's why I'm in this fight.
And so I'm also curious about the internet. One of the things that I actually spend a lot of time thinking about, because working with college students, is actually the way we communicate on the internet, and how once we have an open internet, I guess one of the downsides or byproducts is that anyone can say anything hateful at any time, and that can also get out. And so I'm curious how much of your work is, or maybe will be, about also helping people think about or develop tools to talk with more, I guess, even just respect or anything, like talk to each other like human beings on the internet, or think about communicating on the internet the way you'd communicate with someone who's sitting right next to you.
Yes. Well, it's like a wand, right?
Yeah.
We can use it for great good, and we can use it for destruction. And my job is to make sure that the people who use it for great good, who often don't have the resources, are able to use it. You know, not just moneyed interests have the ability to be heard online. And so I think that the reason it's important to protect it is because there is innovation yet to come that will enable us to be able to have even more fruitful and authentic experiences of talking with one another, of communicating and understanding with one another, of inspiring one another in interactive and dynamic ways. I mean, it's only been around for a couple of decades, and look how far we've come.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine a few more decades from now, you know, what we will be able to experience that will help us feel even more connected with one another. And when we are connected with one another, that is the beloved community, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's this connection, it's people who aren't able to access or be heard online, that creates a sense of a rupture of the beloved community. But if we are connected to each other and we are able to hear and understand one another's stories in a way that comes closer to what it feels like when we're sitting in the same room, then that is the way that we restore the beloved community for future generations. So I believe that innovation is yet to come. I remember the reason I most believe this is because a few years ago, when a white supremacist walked into a Sikh Gurdwara in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, he opened fire. 6 people were murdered.
Mm.
It was, at the time, the largest hate-based mass shooting that the Sikh or Muslim community had ever experienced.
Yeah.
And I felt, you know, similar to how I did after 9/11, that here we were, nothing had changed. I wanted to say that we were still experiencing the aftermath of 9/11, which is simply how the world is now.
Yeah.
And this is where I say, like, your friends will save you. My phone started ringing off the hook. I started getting emails and tweets and Facebook posts from people across the country, including my friends, who were saying, no, you're not alone. What can we do? So the media only captured the story of the mass shooting in Oak Creek for a few days, and it was still trying to get over Sikhism 101. Is Sikhism an offshoot of Islam? How do you pronounce it? You know, we were just getting past that
right
101 conversation and actually starting to cover the actual stories of the people who had survived this violence when the media trucks packed up and they left. And the only way we kept the story alive was online. The only way people knew that the Sikh community walked into that Gurdwara just days after it had become a massacre. They ripped the blood-soaked carpets out of the ground. They repaired the broken windows. They painted over the bullet holes in the walls. And I sat with them as they prayed, as we prayed for the every single person who was killed in that shooting, including the soul of the gunman, including the gunman. that kind of love in the face of the face of the abyss, right?
Right.
In the face of the worst kinds of atrocity, is so powerful that that story is worth being told, because it inspires people to join hands in ways that they never had before. Hmm. Because we kept the story online, we saw vigils across the country. We saw thousands of people pour prayers through Groundswell of love and support to the families. And we organized for a year in a multi-faith movement led by the Sikh Coalition to ask the U.S. government to track hate crimes against Sikhs, Arabs, Hindus, and other minorities. All this time, the U.S. government wasn't even measuring hate crimes against our communities, let alone marshaling all the resources to respond to them. And here again, because it was multi-faith, because we were organizing online through story, we won. A year later, President Obama announced landmark federal policy change. Now, it's not going to prevent another mass shooting, but it is a step down that long road toward a world of justice.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's why I'm in it, because I have seen these moments where it works with the tools at our disposal. And I believe we'll get there if we get there together.
Well, it's a great inspiring note to end on. And I know that I can speak for myself and hopefully for many of our listeners who say thank you for these stories. And we really, really look forward to hearing the stories you continue telling in the future and the causes that you marshal support for in the future.
It was such a pleasure. And, you know, anyone can tell their own story, launch their own campaign at groundswellmovement.org. And if you want to learn a little bit more about the net neutrality site, you can go to faithfulinternet.org.
Great. Thank you very much, Valerie.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Especially like to thank our guest, Valerie Kaur, for such a wonderful and illuminating interview. Special thank you to Brian Young for producing, editing, and doing all things related to the podcast. Also, thank you to Liz Suados for her music, which originally comes from the Of Many film, now available on Vimeo on demand. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions about the podcast, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Those 5-star reviews are super, super helpful for getting us up the iTunes charts, and we actually are seriously interested in all feedback that people have. Thank you so much for listening. We'll look forward to next week's episode.